perspective from the talks we heard this morning. So in two senses. First of all, I would consider the talks we heard this morning a top-down set of talks that is interested in elegant principles, trying to understand, formulate the fundamental laws from basic principles. This talk is going to be much cruder, much dirtier, and much less elegant. It's going to be a bottom-up, just kludging things together and trying to figure out from the bottom up, maybe we can figure out how the fundamental laws work. And the second difference is that, although I think it was stated many of the time, actually was stated during most of the talks, most of the motivation for the talks this morning came from the observation of the acceleration of the universe, this dark energy. So I'm going to be focusing on the other reason for considering modified gravity dark matter. So there's two completely separate motivations. So in those two senses, in those two axes, these talks are completely orthogonal. So first, I want to go over a couple of reasons why, you know, we all believe in dark matter. I do also. I'm just for the next hour or so suspending disbelief. So why is that? Then I'm going to give you a brief introduction to the modified Newtonian dynamics. And basically, this will be propaganda that's evolved over the last 25 years, which I'm just going to spit out with my own take on it. And I haven't worked in this at all, so I have no stake in it. I'm not defensive about it. If you want to attack it, that's fine with me. And then the third thing is people often say that MOND is not a theory. So I'm going to spend a lot of time explaining how developments over the last 25 years or so have turned MOND into something close to a theory. And again, so I should say that this is work by that was initiated by Mordechai Milgram. And this is work that's been done over the last 25 years by Bekenstein and Sanders and collaborators. Again, for most of the talk, I'll finish at 5, I had nothing to do with this work. I'll just give you my spin and why it's interesting to me, but I'm just an observer, basically. And then the last part, the last few minutes, I want to describe the work that I've done with Michele Liguori. And this follows on work that was done partially here at Perimeter by Constantino Scordis. And before that, he worked by himself and then with Pedro Ferreira and David Moda and Cecilia Bohm, I think. So this is the cosmological implications. OK. So that's that one I'm talking about. And yeah, so it's not a long talk. OK, so why dark matter? I want to go through two reasons why I believe in dark matter and why I think we should believe in dark matter. The first one is often unstated and glossed over for reasons that I'll get to. So, and basically, this is the notion that if you plot the overdensity in the universe as a function of time, say the scale factor, so today is 1, and decoupling, recombination happened at redshift of 1,000, that when the scale factor was 10 to the minus 3, right? Well, we know today the delta rho has got to be greater than 1 because we're here, right? And we also measure what the baryon inhomogeneities were like at recombination. That's a picture you saw in almost every talk the first day, right? And we know that's between 10 to the minus 4 and 10 to the minus 5, right? So that pins this down. And we also know, if you use general relativity, how fast inhomogeneities grow from here to here. It's a factor of 1,000. So it looks like this. So therefore, today, we don't have enough structure if you don't have dark matter. If you only have the baryonic stuff that you see today, it just grows like this using general relativity. So, Lyman, I think, or somebody called this a, I forget how many sigma detection, but this is not a 5 or 6 or 10 or 20 sigma detection. This is a we wouldn't be here to discuss it detection, right? Because there's nothing, there's no structure at all in the universe if there's no dark matter. There's no way. We have a picture of what the universe looked like there, and we know how to get from there to there. It's not rocket science, and we know it doesn't do it, right? So that is the first reason why I believe in dark matter. The second reason why I believe in dark matter is galactic rotation curves. So if you plot the velocities of stars around galaxies as a function of their distance from the centers of galaxies, then what you see is a rise and then roughly a flat rotation curve. And this is a problem which is pretty easy to analyze because most of the visible light is in this central region. So you can basically treat this central region as just a point mass. And then the centripetal acceleration, v squared over r, you just set to the Newtonian acceleration, which is Newton's constant times the mass of the galaxy divided by r squared. And what this tells you is that you expect the velocity to be proportional to r to the minus 1/2. That is, we expect the velocity, if this is all the matter there is, to fall off as r to the minus 1/2, and it really doesn't do that, right? So this is a quite extraordinary set of measurements that made over the last 30 years or so that are quite convincing evidence that there's something besides this stuff. So these are two of the many reasons why we all believe in dark matter. Questions about that? Okay. I wasn't expecting to get this far without being accosted. So
just wait.
Just wait. Okay, good. Okay, good. Okay, here we go. Okay. Come on. So in Chicago, you're not even allowed to write these words on the board. Okay, so one. So Mond is predicated on the idea that, you know, it's not really fair to invoke things you don't see to fix problems, right? So maybe the thing to do is to, instead of introducing new types of matter, maybe the thing to do is to argue that Newton's law is modified on large scales. So let's imagine modifying Newton's laws. So Newton's force law. So the simplest way to do it is to say that the true force law, let's talk about the acceleration, so the Newtonian value of the acceleration is mg over r squared, it's got to be mg over r squared for a point mass in the center, right? Forget about the signs. This is a blackboard talk. And so what you might imagine doing is modifying that to be at large distances, so that the force becomes mg over r squared times, say, 1 plus r over r naught. And so at large distances, the acceleration would be different, right? It would be larger on large distances than you would expect. This is a simple modification of Newtonian law that would get that. What would this give you? Well, equate this to the centripetal acceleration. So you set v squared over r. At large distances, that just goes into, this term dominates for r much greater than r naught. So then you set that to mg over r naught. Right. Thank you very much. And this tells you that v is a constant. Right? So this is a simple way of getting constant, constant velocity from modifying Newton's laws, right? The problem with this way of doing things is, this is something that Stacy Mogoff pointed out, that if you did a scatter plot, so let's plot here the mass you infer dynamically versus the mass you infer from just luminous matter, right? So just something like this. Then what you would expect is that for galaxies that are relatively small, this term is not that important, right? So roughly speaking, these two masses would be correct. The dynamical mass would be right for small galaxies. But what you would expect is as the galaxy size becomes bigger, the discrepancy becomes bigger. No, R0 is just a constant. What? It's not Mond. Yeah, it's not Mond. Yeah. So this is this is the simplest thing you might. It's not even. Okay. So this is the simplest thing you might imagine doing. The problem that Stacy points out that when you do that is if you just do a scatter plot of what the velocities look like in this space, it looks like this. That is, there's no correlation of the discrepancy with larger galaxies. So that does not seem to be the way to go. Instead, if you actually use a different x-axis, though, the same quantity, as a function of the acceleration v squared over r of a galaxy, right? Then you actually do see a trend.
Fisher for free. Do you get an exact and they call it Fisher related?
I'm going to actually come to that in a second. So let's see.
Oh, sorry.
No problem. So this is quite nice. This complete nonsensical scatter turns into something quite pronounced. And so what Milgram argued long ago is that there's some fundamental acceleration scale, A naught, Above that scale, Newtonian dynamics is Newtonian.
And below that scale, it must be modified. So what he proposed was the following. He proposed that the true gravitational acceleration is determined by solving this equation. Let's call it A true. This mu is a function of a dimensionless parameter, the true acceleration, divided by some number, A naught. And that is equal to the Newtonian value of the acceleration. And let's just stick to a point mass for now. The Newtonian value is mg over r squared. Right? So, and this function mu, he chose to have the following property. So mu of x is equal to 1 when its argument x is much greater than 1. So in that limit, this is just 1, and the true acceleration is just equal to the Newtonian acceleration. Right? So you get the right answer for a large acceleration galaxy, for things with large acceleration. And that's, you know, stuff on Earth, for example, is way bigger than this fundamental stuff. And then for small values of its argument, it's just equal to its argument itself. So it's a pretty simple function, right? And it looks like this. And therefore, when you plug this in, what you get is solve this equation, you get A true squared divided by A naught is equal to the Newtonian value, which is mg over r squared. So that tells you that the true value of the acceleration is equal to the square root of mg A naught divided by r. And when you plug that in, and you equate this to the centripetal acceleration, v squared over r, this tells you that v squared over r is equal to this thing over r. So it's equal to the square root of mg times a naught. So there are two very nice things about this. The first is you get flat rotation curves for, you know, it's designed to do that. And the second thing is what Will's comment is related to, and that is if you take the square of this, this says that the velocity of the fourth is proportional to the mass, which is presumably proportional to the luminosity. So this tells you that the luminosity, it just falls out of the theory, is proportional to the velocity to the fourth power. And this is the so-called Pauli-Fisher law, which actually is observed with striking regularity on a very wide range of scales. And in fact, just going back to dark matter for a second, it's quite complicated in dark matter theory to explain this relationship. And it's even more complicated to explain the small scatter about this relationship. And in mind, it just falls out, you know, free. So it's quite pretty.
Requires a bunch of self-admitting assumptions. What do you actually mean by complicated?
I don't know what you're saying.
You said it's complicated to explain with conventional dark matter. What's actually the status?
Well, I think you have to just run the simulations, basically, and because it's a very nonlinear process, and you have to pick out galaxies in the simulations and have hydrogen in there, and you have to pick out the elliptical versus the spirals, and you have to, you know, do a high resolution. It's just, I don't think there's a very simple argument. People have tried to do it, but I don't think there's a simple argument which gets at the fact. Daniel Eisenstein and Avi Loeb, some 10 years ago, wrote a paper not trying to explain the Pauli-Fisher law, but trying to explain the spread, the scatter around the Pauli-Fisher law. And they didn't account for any of the complications. They said, just try to calculate the number of things that they give with that kind of mass when you press Schottky and stuff. The scatter is way bigger than the scatter. Just that one simple part of the problem is way bigger than the Pauli-Fisher scatter. So it's two things that the standard model has to do.
I'm not saying it can't do it. I'm just saying it's not simple. And that is explain this relationship and explain the small scatter around it. Other questions?
It's wrong. It's too simple. Because if you use a modified acceleration law, which I use and you use, this is not what you get. So this is a very simple.
This modification
is it's not correct.
Okay.
The second comment is that Joel Bronstein and Drew, non-linear v squares fit the Wells data. For the television is published. And the problem is you have to do the analysis for the asymptotic value is the potential velocity curve. So what we find with the well space data, one is not 4, but 3.2, which by the way happens to be close to what Dr. Mackey gets. So, this is my first two statements.
Okay.
I have a question about the observational
stuff
on the picture. So I heard at some point that there is some balance of the exponent.
My understanding is I'm not even still, but my understanding is it's roughly 3.9 or so. But I haven't done it, so I'm not the person to ask. That's what you're asking about, that.
Yes.
My understanding is it's about 3.9, but I'm not.
Well, wouldn't the measurement depend on the band you use to measure the luminosity?
Yeah. Yeah, so, but that presumably is presumably figured out.
That, right, and so essentially there was a revision of Ursa Major, which was done on the K band. So the most modern data set is 54 galaxies, about half high surface brightness, half low surface brightness in the Ursa Major set. And because all of the galaxies are at the exact same distance, since they're in a galaxy cluster, it reduces a lot of the uncertainty. And because it's in the K band, which is in the infrared, there's not as much dust. And so, as a laboratory, you can plot the Tully-Fisher relationship for just this subset, and you get not 4, not 3.9, but something a lot closer to 3. But of course, the Tully-Fisher relation is a measurement between V to the fourth and luminosity. To connect it to the mass requires you to go through a gravity theory. So when you say the Tully-Fisher relationship is observed, the V to the fourth proportion of the mass can't be observed.
Okay, good. So let's take stock. Why would we abandon the dark matter theory? Why would we listen to less of this one? So first of all, Mark Kamenkowski said last night in a different context, dark matter is like God, right? You just introduce it to fill in the gaps. So that is anything quite sexy. Like something like that. Dark matter relations are like God.
Do you think I misinterpreted the context?
I think I'm misquoting it. The more general point is, it's not really kosher to introduce, to just bring in new particles to fix problems. It doesn't feel good to do that when they've never been seen before, right? I mean, there's got to be some threshold for this. So that is one thing. The second thing is, and this number of experts have questioned how simple this is, but this is out there. And the third thing is something that appeals, this is the thing that actually appeals to me, and again, I'm happy to be correct about this. You look at this theory, when you fit, the dark matter stuff fits the rotation curves very well. The dark matter stuff fits the rotation curves very well. So if you have an individual galaxy, you can fit it with a dark matter model. And there are three free parameters: the mass collect ratio of the stars in the galaxy, and two parameters describing the dark matter distribution. So nowadays it would be like the concentration of the scale and nothing so far. So there's three free parameters that you can fit to the rotation curves of each individual galaxy. And they can do that quite well. There's a Java applet by Chris Mios at Ohio State, it's a nice undergraduate project to do it for any lots of galaxies. So the thing that I find intriguing about this modification is you can do the same, you can fit the rotation curves of the galaxy, but with one free parameter for the galaxy. Right? There's no freedom in this theory whatsoever once you chose the fundamental scale. And the only free parameter then is just the mass plot ratio of the stars. So, and they do quite a good job. Stacey McGaugh's done this for a long time, and he claims to do a very good job fitting rotation curves of galaxies. So that's something that appeals to me, fitting pretty simple shape with one parameter versus three parameters.
To be constant within a particular galaxy, and if you take a look at the study from galaxy to galaxy, the mass-to-light ratio can vary dramatically. So why is the mass-to-light ratio taken as a single constant throughout a galaxy, as opposed to one mass-to-light ratio per data point? In which case,
if you have one mass-to-light ratio per data point, that would not give you any constraints on the theory.
Right, you have no predictability, but you have the right value for the mass-to-light ratio. Then you might want to check your assumption and say, well, if I do have a different mass-to-light ratio for every data point, how correlated are they? Are they really the same mass-to-light ratio? And when you actually do the calculation in an actual galaxy, you find that the variation that occurs within the galaxy exceeds the variation from galaxy to galaxy.
Very interesting.
Okay.
If we keep interrupting.
Sure.
Another problem with all of this it's that V is constant. So when you go to the satellite galaxies, like there's a large survey, STSS, they determine the rotation velocities and velocity dispersion of these satellite galaxies. And one just doesn't fit.
Yeah, I've heard that argument from an unholy proof, and I don't buy that particular argument, but let's not get too caught up in that. I mean, MUN is not a theory that explains structure formation, so understanding the dynamics of, you know, galaxy correlations or things far away, I just don't understand how you could hope to make any predictions in that context. And these satellite galaxies are indeed other galaxies that are statistically properly described with the galaxy-galaxy correlation function. I don't think you can make any claims to be able to predict that in this theory.
Well, if you use my law, no expense for market of gravity, it does fit the data because the acceleration becomes more like it's only in the
Okay. So you see this is a controversial theory. So maybe now is the time to invoke this statement. One thing, I don't know much about MUNs or modified gravity, but I did a little bit about the way, you know, what psychology believes. The notion is that when you're trying to be creative, you're supposed to let ideas in and not reject them just because they're wrong. Because Freud said that from error to error, one discovers the entire truth. So this is my way of asking you to listen to this, even if first you don't buy this second. Okay. So the question. So this is the MUN thing. What does that mean? You make an error, and then instead of discarding the theory, you go to the next error, and then sometimes that first error and the second error can combine to give a theory that makes sense. Okay, so...
It sounds like you're choosing a quote that's as sort of muddled and hard to understand as MUN.
Is there an example?
Okay, so... So let me describe a little bit to some of the work that's been done over the last 25 years or so, trying to put MUND in some kind of a realistic framework. Because right now, it's not really a theory, right? It's just a phenomenological fit, basically, to the data, which is, you know, either it's successful or it's not. It's arguably successful. And the question is, can you put it in a more general theory where you can make predictions for other phenomena? So in order to start this, let me begin by saying that there are two metrics. So the metric appears in two places in our standard version of the action. First, it appears in the Einstein-Hilbert action. And so this is a functional of this metric, and it also appears in the way that in the matter action, in the coupling of the matter to the gravitational field. So I'm going to write this for a point particle, the matter action for a single point particle. And in that case, you can write the action as follows. So these are two places the metric appears, and in general relativity, these two metrics are equal. So we often just naturally equate them. However, it's not necessary to make that equation. So what Bekenstein and collaborator, and actually this predates them, it's just is a general class of generalizations of gravity. What you might imagine doing is imposing some relationship between these two, but not saying they're exactly equal. So, for example, setting g twiddle equal to g up to some conformal factor. So, this is a simple way of generalizing a fully relativistically covariant theory. And what I want to do is show you that if you do this, you can get out some MUN phenomenology. So I suspect this is familiar to certainly all the people who talked this morning, probably most of you, but it's, for me, it's something that I just learned, so I want to just walk you through this exercise. So if you do this, then this manifests itself, so this modification affects the dynamics of particles as follows. If we look at first the effect on a non-relativistic massive particle, so then if it's a non-relativistic massive particle, we can rewrite the action as minus m, then this square root becomes the integral, this g is g twiddle times e to the plus 2 phi, and then it's dx mu, dx nu. So for a non-relativistic particle, you can expand this as follows. The 0, 0 part, the g 0, 0 is equal to minus 1 plus 2 phi, where phi is the Newtonian potential. So the first, the 0, 0 part gives you a factor, and then there's an additional 1 plus 2 phi, assuming this phi is small, from this exponential. So the term that you have multiplying dt squared is 1 plus 2 times the Newtonian potential plus 2 times this new scalar field phi. So there's a difference between the Newtonian potential, right, that's in the metric, and this new scalar field, which relates the two metrics. Right, and I'll get to that in a second. Yeah, exactly. And then just doing a simple expansion, the second part of that is just equal to minus the minus dx squared. So when you expand this around the square root, what you're left with is that the matter action is equal to minus m times 1 plus phi minus v squared over 2. Right? So then what you can do is you can extremize this action. So you take the derivative of the action with respect to, say, v, and that gives you a factor of m times v. And then you take the time derivative of this, and you set it equal to the derivative of the action with respect to x, and that's just equal to minus m times the gradient of phi plus little phi. So the equation of motion becomes, the new equation for the acceleration is equal to minus the usual Newtonian acceleration here, and then minus the gradient of this new scalar field phi. So effectively what you've done is, you, in this new theory, in this scalar tensor theory, what you have is you have an addition to a change in the fundamental dynamics of a massive particle, so that you might imagine, depending on what happens to phi, this little phi over here, you might imagine changing things so you get the right dynamics to my, you know, that mine wants to come out. Let me describe how that's done. So Douglas didn't like this quote. Very sick. So the action, the Lagrangian that you can choose, they wrote, you know, Bekenstein and Sanders wrote a series of papers on this spreading out over about 25 years. And one of the Lagrangians they considered is this one, because it's a naught squared pi g times, this is a naught, this is that fundamental parameter, times a function. So this function, if you think about it, you want this, so this is the acceleration, right? So you want this acceleration, you want this to be acceleration dependent, right? So that on large acceleration it's Newtonian, and on small acceleration it goes to this Mond limit. So this function has to be a function it's not a potential energy, it's really going to be a function of the kinetic term. So the thing that's non-standard in these models is not the potential of the scalar field, it's rather the kinetic term. So this is a functional of the derivatives. Right, and then there's the usual matter action. So when you extremize this, the full Lagrangian, this thing, plus the matter thing with respect to phi, what you get out, so let's do this, let's take the derivative of this Lagrangian with respect to phi. Respect to phi, comma alpha, where the comma denotes derivative with respect to x. And we're going to take the derivative of this with respect to x alpha. So this is the derivative with respect to x alpha. X alpha. And then we take the derivative of this. We have an a naught squared over 8 pi g. So let's take the derivative of f with respect to its function. Let's just call it f prime. And then let's differentiate the argument of the function with respect to phi prime. And then what comes down is a 1 over a naught squared times 2 d phi dx alpha. Right? So that's the answer. And then, so this reduces to 1 over 4 pi g times the derivative with respect to x alpha. And then there's an f prime d phi dx alpha. OK, so question about that? This is a simple calculation. And what you need to set that to is a derivative with respect to of Lagrangian with respect to phi. And that, let's just take a simple point mass again as the source of this phi field to see what happens in our galaxy case. It turns out that delta SM delta phi, delta LM, L, whatever, delta LM delta phi is just equal to minus M times a delta function. So the equation then becomes the derivative with respect to x alpha of f prime times the derivative of phi with respect to x alpha is equal to minus 4 pi g m times a delta function. So simple thing is that if f prime is equal to 1, which it will be for a large, when the argument is large, and this thing is much larger than a naught squared, when this argument is very large, f prime will be equal to 1. And therefore, this left-hand side just reduces to the Laplacian of phi, right? So it becomes the Laplacian of phi is just equal to minus 4 pi gm del 3 of r. So that means this is roughly this is the Poisson equation. So this phi is going to satisfy the exact same equation that the Newtonian potential is. So what's going to happen over here in the Newtonian limit is you'll get two contributions to the potential, the standard one and this new one, and they'll both behave exactly the same. So the only thing that's different in this region is that Newton's constant is a factor of 2 smaller than usual. Okay, so that's the simple case. Question about that? About what? Not quite yet. But right. So the first thing I was going to do was massless particles and then massless particles. Right. So then, let's just look at the case then where there's only a radial dependence. So this just becomes derivative with respect to R. Let's integrate out to a surface of capital R, and with this, and then invoke Gauss's theorem. And what you get is that f prime times phi prime is equal to 4 pi is equal to gm over r squared. Like, so again, in the case that in the large acceleration limit, f prime is 1, so you get the standard Newtonian formula. But in the case where f prime, where the acceleration is small, you're going to get a different Riemannian result. So f prime, you get to make the exact same set of choices. But f prime is equal to 1 in the case that its argument, phi prime squared over a naught squared, is much greater than 1. And in the opposite limit, you just set it equal to phi prime over a naught. And this reduces to the Mann phenomenology. So this is a pretty simple way to get out the exact Mann phenomenology, which at least some people claim is very desirable within the context of the field theory. Yeah?
These are relativistic formulas. What do you mean by phi prime?
I'm just looking at a non-relativistic case in the galaxy.
Right. But so if it's just, if time is just a function of R, I understand what you mean. But
In Lagrangian, it's the full defined, it's the fully covariant defined the epsilon.
Right. So what do you mean by phi prime in a fully covariant way?
Well, I'm solving it in this case, where in the non-relativistic case, in the general case, you can solve the theory, you can solve it, you know, if it's say time dependent. So in this particular case, I'm not understanding your question.
So just what is, I just want to know what
your derivative phi is back R, sorry.
Yeah, no, so I want to know what your function phi.
Phi is just radial in the case where you're just looking at.
I want to know what your function f is in general, that such that f prime becomes d by
so f prime of x is equal to 1 and x to the 1 half.
Okay, good.
In the 2.
Can I ask you a question? These kinds of P of x theories, you have to worry about whether the energy density is positive.
Right. So there's been a lot of work on the stability of these theories, and I don't really know much about them. The only thing I'll say about that is that typically people don't stick with this thing, which I consider the simplest thing. They tend to introduce auxiliary fields, and then with some terms of canonical kinetic terms which couple to other fields, and then the other fields have simple dynamics such that when you substitute it in, you get a kinetic term which looks something like this. So you have a standard kinetic term multiplied by a field, and when you solve for that, the classical solution for that field leads to some crazy kinetic term. So in my mind, that's just I think there are some of those classical theories which don't suffer from this problem.
Well, and how many free parameters are we fitting rotation with?
That's fine, right? This discredits your statement before about the rotation curve, because here you even have to introduce auxiliary fields.
Well, I think those
are old functions, you don't know what they are.
Uh-huh. Right.
So
okay, I can see where that
more compared to
that. Right. You can see that. That would be disturbing too. Yeah.
I don't know whether you're going to discuss Frankenstein's tables in detail, but we can show.
Yeah,
that.
I will.
So I'll wait.
Okay. Good. So let's get a little bit now to the question from before, so that. This was a case of massive particles, so it does a good job producing phenomenology. For massless particles, it does not do a good job accounting for phenomenology.
And the way to see that is to note that, at least the way that I see it, is that the invariant squared for a massless particle is equal to, this is coupled to the metric without the twiddle on it. So it looks like this. And this is related by a conformal factor, so this is equal to g twiddle mu nu e to the 2 phi dx mu dx nu. And this is just zero, so you can get rid of this thing. So basically what the bottom line is in this theory is you take the metric which appears in the Einstein-Hilbert action, you solve that, so in our simple case it would be just the Newtonian potential, using the standard ways, and all there is baryons in that case, so you get the standard metric over here, and therefore, the massless particles obey the same geodesics as they would in a standard GR theory, right? There's no difference between this theory and the standard GR theory. So that was the question that you were asking. So that is a big problem, because we have quite a bit of evidence that there is lensing that there is lensing far beyond the visible sector of a galaxy. So that, in my mind, the best evidence for this is if you look at the shears of back, you'll sit on a foreground galaxy, and you look at the galaxies behind it, and you measure the shears of it as a function of distance from that foreground galaxy, and you plot that as a function of distance. So if all there was visible matter, this should fall off very, very sharply, because the visible matter is sharply concentrated in the center. But actually, we see signal far out to hundreds of kiloparsecs in some cases. So this is very difficult to understand in the context of this simple model. So what Bekenstein and Sanders have pointed out is that you can evade this constraint if you slightly expand your notion of how these two metrics are related to one another. And in particular, both of them suggested that they could be related in the following way. So there's this usual thing that the way in which they're related. But now they introduce a vector field, which changes the one-to-one, kind of the linear, direct linear relationship between the two metrics. And if you introduce that, then you get a much more complicated relationship. And this, in the celebrated paper of Bekenstein a couple of years ago, he showed that if you introduce this generalization, then you do indeed get the requisite lensing. So you reduce Taman phenomenology in one case, and you get the lensing in the other case. That's quite nice. And then, in addition to all that, you have a comprehensive theory with which you can do and you can attack any problem, for example, cosmology. So what I'd like to do, unless there's some onslaught of comments, is to explain how the cosmology works in this model. Yeah?
Take Bekenstein's Lagrangian. You find that you fall the Hamiltonian, you find it's unstable.
You mentioned it, yeah.
It's a straightforward calculation. Also, not far away from the student at the university, like the second, obviously showing the dispersion. It's stable, it's going well. The sun, the background, the time scale of the visibility for the sun only shines 2 weeks, which is not
good. Okay.
This is a serious problem. The problem is the way that the field comes into the Lagrangian.
I guess I don't understand Douglas's comment before. It seems to me at this stage, it really is quite important to understand that we're trying to deal with phenomena which can only be explained by invoking new particles. That's a revolutionary idea. So if we're going to consider other ideas, we can't just run away from them every time there is an objection to them. So in this case, there's some instability people have looked at, but is that fundamental to the results in this, for example, the Mond limit, or the lensing result, or the cosmological result I'm about to show? I honestly don't know. But that, I think, is the thing you have to do. If you're going to show that there's a flaw in it, and you have to show that that's fundamental and that derails the whole program. I haven't seen any evidence of that.
So the point is well taken. So I did the calculation with the instability. And it was so simple it doesn't seem to be worth publishing it. If you have a vector field, which is not a gauge field, and you work out the Hamiltonian formulation, there's a missing constraint because the Gauss's law constraint is normally constrained, and you therefore just have to plug it in. And when you plug it in, the Hamiltonian is no longer bounded from below, and that does seem to be a reason to reject it.
Why?
Just do the calculation.
Yeah, but why is it a reason to reject it?
Roughly speaking,
I mean, you can say when you have four Fermi theory. Would you reject four Fermi theory? I mean, there could be elements
of course
that
are under four Fermi.
Right, but I'm saying, we certainly use it. It's an effect on the Lagrangian, which is extremely useful. So what I'm saying is that there might be pieces of this theory that, I mean, you mentioned the vector part of it. There's also a big problem from the scalar potential part of it, which are quite ugly. But I don't understand the philosophy, honestly, that if you find one hole in it, you reject it.
I have nothing against investigating it, but I think you should be... One should be mindful of the fact that adding vector fields to gravitational theories is something that's been well studied, there's a long history to, and almost always leads to a theory that is unstable because the energy is not bounded from below. It's not a new discovery.
Okay.
And one should be... Okay. Now, there are a few exceptions, and one should try to work within that class of exceptions. So
okay. Good point. I want to get to my work, because we should have just stopped.
Let me just ask you a question. Adding a vector field to gravity automatically violates the Coulomb's principle.
Sure. It violates the strong of Coulomb's principle, not the weak Coulomb's principle.
That's right.
That's the extent of my knowledge of that. So.
But just one comment.
Sure.
You're trying to compete with Einstein.
I'm trying to compete with Freud, you know this
guy. This is what's happening here. This is a very get off of the right foot from the beginning. Because Einstein's theory has a perfectly stable vacuum.
I just completely disagree with that, Father. We're not going to solve it. I mean, you can say the same thing about the four Fermi theory. It's fundamentally flawed, so why even look at it? But I just don't understand why.
Okay, well,
but we're not going to, this is a personal thing.
The modified Einstein theory has a vector field. The theory is perfectly stable. I made sure of that before I started.
Okay.
But can I make one comment?
Sure, yeah.
You are unhappy to introduce new particles, but there are new particles that are well motivated for other reasons. For example, axions and minimal and supersymmetric.
I strongly disagree with that, but the first part of that, axions are well motivated at a specific scale when they're ruled out. So that was, but then supersymmetric particles. Yeah, I mean, there's motivation for it, but if you think about it, the biggest motivation for, one of the strongest motivations for supersymmetry is dark matter, so it's a little bit circular. But anyway,
the only reason for you introducing these two new fields is to solve the Gaussian rotation curve. Whereas the reasons for introducing axions was to solve other problems.
Well, that's not completely true. So let me address that here. So I think I could say something constructive here, but I really kind of disagree. So one point about this number A naught, which is the new fundamental mass scale in this Lagrangian. So you can estimate what it is. It's just roughly V squared over R. V squared is 200 kilometers per second divided by 10 kiloparsecs or so. And it's equal to the Hubble stuff today. So why is that important? Because we had four talks this morning, every single one of which introduced a new fundamental scale in the Lagrangian with this mass scale. So it could be, so your argument is, I shouldn't be defensive, but I have no sleep. You're right, right? Your dark matter exists probably. But the argument countering that would be, you believe there's a new fundamental mass scale at a TEV that has a new phenomenology, but there are now two pieces of evidence, dark matter and dark energy, pointing to a new fundamental scale of 10 to the minus 33 degree. So it could be that the new fundamental scale is there, or it could be it's there. That's no way to look at this. But it's interesting that there are two completely separate pieces of evidence pointing to the exact same mass scale.
But if you believe in dark matter, the issue going to take the other side is to explain the occurrence of A0 in the galactic and the data from observing galaxies. Because you can read
that's right, that's right, yeah, that's right, yeah, exactly.
By the way, it's not
I feel like I've been very coherent here, and I risk being less clear in answering that question, because I guess, to make a long story short, I don't think the lensing has been calculated for an asymmetric profile in this theory. So I don't think you can make quantitative conclusions. You might have some intuition about what you should get. I don't have such intuition, but there are, I don't know. But you might have intuition about what you get, in which case maybe you can make some claims. I really like the idea that cosmology has moved forward into the Lyman Page, Mark Hopper network, where now we look at maps, and don't point at individual things and say we ruled out theories. So the whole argument got me upset. But even if you believe that you can make an argument from a single thing, you haven't done that with this theory because no one's calculated the signal theory. So I have 10 minutes left to describe what I did. And so I have learned a lesson though here today. So I've never talked about tethers. So here's the cosmology. So if you want to do the cosmology, you have a couple of new fields, and you have a fundamental theory. You just go ahead and calculate. So the zero order cosmology. So there's two parts. The first is the zero order cosmology, and this program was hindered because there are some analytic solutions people found. And as you know, when you find analytic solutions, you get in trouble because they're always not relevant. So people got sidetracked with scaling, all that stuff. But really, you just solve it numerically, and it's quite simple to find out what happens in the zero-order cosmology. There are basically two changes. The first is that Newton's constant becomes some effective constant, which depends upon this field phi. But it's roughly the same thing. So within a few percent, it's the same thing. So there's basically no difference. And the second change is that you had to add to the Friedmann equation, you have to add a new term, a new source to the Friedmann equation, which is due to the energy density of the phi particles. And it turns out that that is very small. So basically, the zero-order cosmology is the same. Okay. So the interesting thing happens when you go to the first-order cosmology. You look at perturbations around this zero-order cosmology. So what you have to do is you have to perturb the ordinary stuff, right? The gravitational metric and the overdensities and the velocities and the baryons and the photons that do the standard hierarchy of coupled equations. But you have to add the fact that there are these new fields and perturb them. So you have to write the scalar field is a function, I'm going to use eta as conformal time, is a function of
you know, it's got its zero order value, and then you perturb around its zero order value. And then the vector field is a little bit complicated, at least it was for me. This, in principle, depends on position and data. And this is equal to the scale factor times e to the minus phi bar times 1, 0, 0, 0. So Bekesine chose this vector field so that it has a unit norm. So this zero-order thing is just pointing in the time direction, and it's got unit norm. Because of this constraint that it has unit norm, the perturbations are constrained. Instead of having four independent numbers, like you would have for a vector field, there's only three, right? And so the time component of this is phi plus phi. And then there's the spatial component of that. Two of these components, the two transverse components, decouple from the scalar equations. And therefore, they're irrelevant. So they have, you're basically left with one new variable you have to track its evolutions. You have to track the evolution of phi and alpha through time as you and couple that. And there are coupled equations with the regular stuff. So what? Let me just summarize one such equation. So in particular, the Poisson equation, which relates gravitational potentials to overdensity, that gets generalized. So this is the standard term. Right? And then there's a new term, and I don't remember what the coefficient is, but it's proportional to alpha. This is not shocking, right? If you imagine, you know, putting these equations and these terms are now coupled everywhere, it's not shocking that you get a new term in the equations, you know, breaking that simple relationship between the potential and the energy density. Okay? So here's the thing that I found. I guess I've got 5 minutes. Sorry? Oh, okay. Thanks. Which, what?
Is this in one of them?
Right, so you're talking about this is in the
G-filter frame or G.
Right. This is thank you. This is in the
But what do we observe? The
potential is in the thing that appears in the gravitational metric. So that's the Einstein frame, right? Is that right? Yeah, that's the thing that appears in the Einstein hybridization. So perturb the metric, I believe, so that G twiddle is equal to has this phi. So that and you're right, this it doesn't really matter. I mean, what happens is there's some relationship between the two which has some phi's in it. It has some little phi's in it. And basically, you can do it any frame you want, as long as you're... You know,
I understand. Yeah. I was debating.
Okay. I mean, so again, I'm an outsider, but it seems to me this whole notion of frames is kind of... I don't understand how that's important. I mean, you have an action, you just vary the action to get the equations in motion. So, I mean, it's true in some frames, one of the actions simplifies the other is less, but who cares? I mean, you just get the equation.
But what you measure...
Yeah. Right. That's what you're saying, yeah. As you can tell, I haven't been that careful about that, but I think I've done the right. So,
I guess it's just a question. So this G tilde is the one that appears in Lichtenstrahler?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay,
yeah.
So then it's like a string train.
Okay, so anyway, this vector field, so it's clearly important to solve, you solve the full set of equations simultaneously, but I found it useful to extract out this one piece. And this one piece looks like this. The equation governing the evolution of alpha is this plus 2 over a to the square 1 plus epsilon times alpha. And this epsilon here is something which is proportional to that little phi bar. Remember, phi bar is quite little. It's quite small. So it's So if you plot 5R in standard cosmology, it's quite small. So this is 10 to minus 2 or so. It looks something like this. So it's a very small number. So basically, you know, you can treat it as a perturbative thing. I'm running out of time, so I just give you the punchline. The punchline is that if you, and there's a source term here which depends on, it's a functional of the potential. If you look at this homogeneous equation, right, and set epsilon equal to 0, you basically get a couple of decaying words. So basically, this alpha does nothing interesting. If you account for the fact, though, that the full equation includes this evolution of 5, at some point, this term is going to become big for a certain, in a certain parameter space in this Beckenstein theory. And what's going to happen is this term is going to drive alpha to grow very fast. So for the set of parameters that people were looking at, alpha actually does grow quite fast. So what happens is these vector perturbations, which remember, the whole vector field was introduced to get lens in, right? So you had an error in your theory, and the error was that you weren't getting lensing, so you introduced something, you lived with that, and you tried to fix it and stuff like that. Introduced these vector perturbations. They grow very rapidly. And that rapid growth feeds into the growth, a rapid growth in the overdensities. So going back to the first plot that I showed, here's where we measure 10 to minus 3 and 1, so the scale factor. This is delta rho over rho. So we pin down the variable density at 10 to the minus 4 or 5 back at recombination. And if you just do, this is 1, if you just do standard GR, it grows to 10 to the minus 1 by today. But if you do a variant-only model in the context of this model of gravity, you get enhanced growth. So you get above the linear scale. You get nonlinear structures. So that means this vector field, which was introduced for a completely different reason, to get lensing, drives the system so that you get enough growth of the perturbation, the scalar perturbations in cosmology, so you can solve what I consider to be the most daunting problem that any no dark matter theory has to face. So this, to me, I was trying to play devil's advocate in some sense. So, dark matter has a lot of strong reasons for it. But to me, the two intriguing things about this model are, first of all, this A-naught thing, the fact that there's evidence for a new fundamental scale in the modified action. And the second thing is this idea that, you know, Beckenstein, who wasn't studying cosmology, introduced a vector field. And that turns out to solve what I consider to be the most difficult problem for these no dark matter models. That's it.
So what about self-damping in small-scale structure?
What's CMD?
Right? Small-scale structure, if all you have is baryons, it's going to be wiped out, and you're not going to have any small-scale structure in the universe. Right?
I'm just confused by that, because in the initial paper by Scordis et al., which was a beautiful, beautiful paper, they invoked that to explain this rise, and I don't think it was correct. So I'm just confused. I don't know. Let me say this. I don't think that the linear power structure has been studied enough. But if you start out with silk dam, whatever, if it suppressed fluctuations on a smaller scale, you could imagine them being amplified by this mechanism. So, for example, the scale that we looked at did indeed grow above the nonlinear scale. I'm not talking about the shape of power structure, but the amplitude. So, getting even the linear power structure might have done what we've been done yet. So that's the transfer.
At what level do you expect the strong equivalence principle to be in Thailand today?
By this thing?
Yes.
Right. Good question. I don't know the answer. Yeah.
Justin was saying. So one question. So at the end of the alpha is the perturbation of your vector?
Yeah, right.
So So you only need one degree of freedom in some sense.
Right.
So my question, why do you have to use a vector explicitly? Why not use the gradient of the scalar?
I mean, write this.
I know you want to fix the norm because you get six.
So this is the longitudinal component. So I guess you could write it as you do end up writing it as it, but It is a scale, right? One of the components, but we're looking at the longitudinal component. Yes, it does transform the scale.
We need a vector to do the bending of the line. This is work with the gradient of the scale.
Any more questions?
You get enhanced growth, and it's probably scale dependent.
Right, right.
So, and you need enough of it to get rid of our method, but wouldn't we restore it?
Yeah, that's the weird thing. Yeah, so I mean, I fluffed the question of the power spectrum. Sort it's about plenty to calculate it, and they find that the power spectrum looks fine. Which I don't really understand. I would think you'd see these big oscillations, and I don't know the answer. I don't think it's been there. The only thing I'm claiming is that you get enhanced growth. I'm not talking about shape and structure. I mean, think about how long it took to get the right shape of stuff in GR, right? And this is all part of theory, and only a couple of people have looked at this. So it's not shocking beyond the way it's
here. That's the last question.
Yeah, so the Bond people used to say that they would get enhanced growth of structure because the gravitational force is stronger at longer distances because of slower fallout. Is that related to the mechanism you actually see?
No, because if we turn the vector for this alpha field off, then you do not get enhanced growth. So
that's nothing to get settled.
Yeah.
Okay, let's then start again.